call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. Members, today we have several bills on the agenda, and as a reminder to the public, the only public testimony we'll be taking on the bills today are from individuals who signed up in advance per last Friday's announcement and the agenda posting on the committee webpage. Before we get into the bills, we need a motion to approve the minutes for March 10th, 2023.
So move, Madam Chair.
Representative Frazier moves the minutes for March 10th, 2023. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes for March 10th, 2023 are approved. The first bill we have today is a Representative Jordan bill, House File 81, and it's related to fish kills. Members, it's in our jurisdiction because of the very small fiscal appropriation to the BCA. So I will move that House File 81 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy. Welcome to the committee. Representative Jordan, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here to discuss something I think a little different than what you typically discuss in this committee, which is House File 81, which addresses how our state responds to fish kills and then alerts the public. Fish kills are a mass die-off of fish in a body of water. They're uncommon, but they are an indication of something wrong. There are two types of fish kills, and we have different agency responses based on the fish kill. The first type is one that stems from a weather-related event. So, for example, shallow bodies of water can freeze solid in winter and then kill the fish. Conversely, extreme heat can also kill fish, and we saw a fish kill of this example in the Pacific Northwest in the summer of 2021. In Minnesota, the DNR's fisheries team is the lead agency to respond to fish kills. The second type of fish kill is the result of a toxin in the water that kills the fish in a body of water. In that circumstance, the MPCA is the lead agency to report on and respond to the fish kills. And while we already have interagency response protocols, we need to make sure the public is aware of fish kills when they happen, especially when there's a potential public health impact. The name of the game when responding to fish kills is speed. And so while this bill, House File 81, has changed since the fiscal note was created, the financial assumptions for the BCA should be the same and can be found on page 21 of the fiscal note. And this is the portion of the bill that is in the committee's jurisdiction. And so this bill would require the duty officer on duty to start the process to begin the agency interagency response. So basically the call goes into the BCA, and the BCA says, okay, we need the MPCA, MDH, and DNR to get to the Mississippi River in northeast Minneapolis to investigate why there are suddenly 1,000 dead fish on the shores. And so the total cost for the BCA portion of the bill is $7,000 a year. Ideally, as the bill will require reporting on how to prevent fish kills in the future, this cost could go down over time. And this language is still being worked on with advocates and our state agencies, and we'll be headed back to environment with your support. And with that, Madam Chair, I can stand for questions. And there are people in the audience who can answer questions if they exist.
Thank you for that explanation. And nobody from the public signed up to testify about the bill, so we'll move right into member discussions. Representative Becker-Fent.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And a little odd to have this in this committee, but I do think it is important to sort of lift up that public safety can involve things like the public, human safety when we have a pollution event. And this also just kind of highlights how important it is that, you know, if we have animals or fish or plants that are dying, we should be looking at the causes to make sure that there aren't negative impacts on humans and our constituents as well. So glad we could move this along this year. Thank you.
Representative Nabotny.
That question about routing out of the bill, Chair Mueller, has it been agriculture? Or?
Madam Chair, I can't hear Representative Nabotny.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. This work? All right. Madam Chair, question about the routing of this bill. Does it need to go to agriculture or health yet?
Representative Jordan.
Madam Chair, it needs to go back to environment. And from there, it could go to other committees. But at this time, I don't believe so.
Representative Navani.
Just feel that it should go through agriculture and health and probably higher ed. Can talk about it offline.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Botney. So the fiscal note is an earlier iteration of the bill. There are no the financial components of the bill are through, and so the portion about the U of M is no longer in the bill. And some of the reporting around the courts was also addressed in the engrossment that we adopted in environment. For further amendments, they need to go back to environment. And so the fiscal note is an old fiscal note that is an older version of the bill. The bill has been narrowed rather considerably. It does not include things like rulemaking, for example, or anything related to courts or the U of M or other departments. And so it might be, there is some discussion around amending this to think about who could report to a Fishkill, but at this time that amendment would be better addressed back in environment, and I am not anticipating any further cost to the BCA or public safety.
Anything further, Representative Vanni?
Thank you, Chair.
Any closing comments, Representative Jordan?
I just ask for more support.
All right. With that, I renew my motion and we refer House File 81 to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thanks for being here. All right, the next bill we have on the agenda is House File 181. This is a Representative Vang bill. And members, we heard this bill on January 17th. At that hearing, we adopted the A2 amendment, but since we laid the bill over, it was not officially engrossed yet, so that's why you have the A2 amendment in your packets and it's posted online. So I will move that House File 181, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. We do have an author's amendment, the A3 amendment. And members, since we have fully discussed this bill already and we had public testimony, we're only going to discuss the A3 amendment. So before voting on that, I'll give Representative Vang an opportunity to explain the amendment, and then we'll move to member discussion on the A3. So I will move the A3 amendment. Go ahead and explain it to us, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Much of the discussion has already been had, so I'll keep it short. The highlight of this bill is to address the rise in hate and bias incidents against a protected class and have only become more urgent in recent events. Just yesterday, the FBI released their 2021 report that reported on just hate crimes alone an increase of 11.6% from 8,120 in 2020 to 9,065 in 2021 across the country. Around 65% of the victims were targeted because of their race, ethnicity, or ancestry. Around 16% of reported incidents were linked to bias against a person's sexual orientation, while approximately 14% were linked to a religious bias. They continue to note that there is an underreporting of hate crimes and the need to do better reporting. That is what the highlight of this bill is trying to address, which is to support the community on reporting bias and hate incidents, as we've all seen a rise in the continued rise of these incidents since the pandemic. The author's amendment makes a lot of it our technical changes and aligns with existing statutes. It also addresses some of the concerns mentioned in the previous discussion that clarifies that a bias and hate incident has to be a substantial part of the incident. It also clarifies data practices and makes a change on the post-board training process. And with that, I'm happy to answer any question.
Okay, great. So we'll move to discussion on the A3 amendment. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Vang, can you provide a hypothetical example of what would constitute a bias having a substantial.
We're having trouble hearing. I don't know if it's because your hand is there. I think the mics, they seem to not be picking up very well today. So
I'll try to speak up a little
bit more. I'm also not feeling well, so it could be my problem too.
I'll try to speak up a little bit more. I'm wondering, Representative Vang, if you could provide a hypothetical example of what might constitute bias having a substantial impact or role in an incident that would be part of the information aggregated under this bill.
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson, for your question. An example could be what is considered an incident but not necessarily a crime. For example, an individual can distribute anti-Semitic and white supremacist flyers. This conduct, while clearly motivated by bias, is not criminal.
Representative Hudson.
So if it's not criminal, if a law is not being broken and they're disseminating speech, reprehensible though that speech may be, what is the state interest in documenting non-criminal speech?
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hudson, what this bill addresses is that speech of that creates imminent threat and incitement to violence is not protected. You have a lawful right to demonstrate and protest and have a freedom of speech. But if that speech incites threat and incitement to violence, that can be considered a crime.
Representative Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Vang. Is incitement to violence currently legal in the state of Minnesota?
Representative Vang.
Representative Hudson, I believe I don't want to make a. We can reference the January 6th riot, if we, which is not part of what this bill is trying to address.
Just to remind everyone, we're going to focus on the A3 amendment. So I'm not sure if your question relates to the A3 amendment. Could you perhaps rephrase it?
Sure, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to do that. So the A3 amendment is making adjustments to language in order to clarify the intention of the author, presumably in response to the discussion we had. I mean, you stated that the discussion we had earlier on this same bill. And so I'm just trying to understand where this is landing. Like, at the end of the day, what problem is this solving that is not currently addressed by state law?
Representative Bank.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I said before, currently there are no infrastructure for communities to report when a bias and hate incidents has occurred. The only existing statute right now is that if a hate crime happens, the individual can only report to a police officer. Right now, members of our communities, neighbors don't trust the police, and so oftentimes the police officer won't get that information, and they will often report to a community leader or a community organization. So what this bill does is create that infrastructure to allow community organizations to work with the Department of Human Rights to compile bias and hate incidents that are occurring within their own communities.
And just a reminder, too, this is going to the Judiciary Committee, which does have jurisdiction over the Human Rights Department. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I appreciate the additional information regarding the intention and the context. I'll forego making broader points regarding my concerns. I think those were expressed in the previous committee hearing, but you know, just suffice it to say, I hope we're very careful when we start to blur this line between what is a crime and what is an actionable incident by the government, that we're not treading upon First Amendment liberties. Thank you.
Further discussion to the A3. All right, closing comments on the amendment. Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For hearing this bill twice, as an Asian American woman and seeing headlines of other Asian American women, Michelle Goh, Christina, Yuna Lee, just to name a few of the many cases we've seen across the country, targeted, unprovokedly attacked and killed. Our safe spaces, our the train, our work, our home, our grocery stores don't feel as safe as it used to. This bill only seeks to improve the reports of hate and bias incidents so that we can see the full picture of where these incidents are happening and hope to prevent future loss of life and preserve human dignity. And with that, thank you, Madam Chair.
All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. And now we need to get the bill out of committee. Don't go away yet, Representative Vang. We just did the amendment. So now I will renew my motion and re-refer House File 181 as amended to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thanks for coming back. We appreciate it. Okay, we have Representative or Chair Becker-Finn up next. We're hearing House File 1877. Chair Becker-Finn, would you like to move your bill? It's my understanding that the motion is to recommend that House File 1877 be placed on the general register.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. And there are no amendments, so please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a pretty straightforward. So as folks may be familiar with, if there are controlled substances crimes that occur within certain places, like around treatment centers or schools or parks, that's considered an aggravating factor when those incidents are prosecuted. what we've found out is that there is a little bit of a loophole in the law where a park that's designated by a tribal government as opposed to a county or a city currently does not fall under that definition. So all this does is add tribal governments to the types of governments that can designate a park, and that those aggravating factors would apply if there are incidents happening in tribally designated parks.
Okay, great. And your testifier, I believe, is Matthew Bergeron.
He's just here for questions, if there are any. This was brought to us by one of the tribal governments who has a park who would like to be able to have that treated as an aggravating factor if there are controlled substances crimes happening in that park.
Great. And we didn't have anybody from the public sign up to testify. We do have a letter of support in the packets, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Devani.
Chair Moeller, children should be able to play at a park no matter where they live. I'm in favor of this.
Any further discussion? Closing comments, Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you for your time.
All right, Representative, or Chair Becker-Finn renews the motion that House File 1877 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The next bill we'll be hearing today is House File 1510. This is my bill, but members, per the agenda posting, we're going to be combining several Department of Public Safety policy bills into the Delete All Amendment. And this is an agency, this is a series of bills by the agency, so I'm going to stay up here while the commissioner and agency staff present the bill. But first, I will move that House File 1510 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. And then I will move the DE2 amendment. And we do have nonpartisan staff that's going to walk us through this amendment, and I'll call on Mr. Diebel to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The DE2 amendment begins with Section 1, is a piece from Representative Burns, House File 1648, and it updates a reference from the Department of Corrections, excuse me, to the Department of Public Safety to reflect the current responsibility for this program. Section 2 is a Representative Moeller bill, the underlying 1510, and it allows the Commissioner of Public Safety to accept donations and transfers from non-governmental sources. Sections 3 through 8 of the proposal are from Representative Hewitt's House File 1759, and these make a variety of changes to the emergency management, bomb squad definitions, and responding to bomb and bomb sweeps, as and allows for agencies to bill the cost of bomb sweeps to event organizers who request those services. Jumping forward to Section 9, this is the questioned identity process from Representative Kern's House File 1524. Provides the process for those who believe that their identity is linked to erroneous information in the BCA databases to correct those records. Sections 10 through 12 of the DE2 are from Representative Kern's House File 1777, and they relate to the Juvenile Justice Advisory Group and adds duties for the group, and includes advising the superintendent on emerging technology, privacy interests, and other bureau initiatives. And then it contains some conforming changes as well. The final section that I'll cover in the DE2 is Section 13. This is also a piece from Representative Hughes, House File 1759, and relates to smoke detectors and clarifying that they are should be referred to as smoke alarms in statute. And I ask that you recognize Mr. Johnson to continue with the overview.
Thank you. Over to you, Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, Sections 14 and 15 are both from House File 2205. These amend the computer theft statute to clearly apply the unauthorized copying of electronic data, even when the act does not prevent the rightful owner from accessing or possessing that data. Sections 16, And 17 are from Representative Turan's House File 1647. These require prosecutors to make reasonable efforts to notify victims of the date and time of a sentencing hearing and a hearing at which a plea will be presented, and also make a technical change to clarify that it's the prosecutors and not the courts that have responsibility for giving that notification. The next group of sections, which are sections 18 all the way through section 35 and also include section 39, are all from Representative Holland's House File 1713. These replace the term reparations with reimbursement in those sections that address the reimbursement of crime victims. Section 22 specifically also clarifies that cooperation with law enforcement can be documented through law enforcement records, prosecution records, and certifications from victim services groups. Moving to section 36, sections 36 through 38, and also section 40, clarify that the Office of Justice Programs and not the Department of Corrections is the designated agency responsible for domestic abuse funding. These are from Representative Curran's House File 1648. Madam Chair, that is all the sections in the deed.
All right, thank you for that excellent walkthrough. And we do have a couple of amendments to the DE2. The first one I will move, it's the A2 amendment, and it's just making a technical change where there was some language that needed to be updated that we missed the first time. All those in favor of, well, first, any discussion on the A2 amendment? All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. The next amendment we have is the A3. Who will be offering the A3 amendment?
That'll be me, Chair Moeller.
Representative Novotny to the A3.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. A3 is an amendment that is just adding some language that would restrict the donation of money with strings attached. They cited in some of these working groups in the Deadly Encounters Working Group that Department of Public Safety was not able to accept gifts. This amendment still allows people to make donations to the Department of Public Safety, but it does not allow the gift giver to put conditions on the gift. For example, if Elon Musk wants to give the Minnesota State Patrol $100 million, but as a requirement of the gift, the State Patrol must replace all the cars with electric vehicles, that would be prohibited. This amendment still allows the gift giver to designate the division or programs where he or she wants the money to go. There just can't be strings attached to the donation. That the Department of Public Safety has to change policy or practice. From a practical standpoint, my first cop job was at the city of Princeton, and for those of you older than I am, the controversy at the city of Princeton was a young individual came to the Princeton City Council with literally a bag full of money. And yes, Representative Hewitt's old enough to remember. He came literally with a bag full of money and gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to the city of Princeton. They bought squad cars, and in exchange, he wanted access to the record systems. So I came in after that, but lived with the after effects of someone and seeing the damage that donations with strings attached can do to a community. So that is my feelings about this bill, and I hope you accept it as a friendly amendment.
Thank you. It's my understanding that I can certainly understand the intent of where you're going with this. It's my understanding that this would actually, though, however, make it harder for them to get grants, which was what they wanted to do as a result of that Deadly Force Encounters Working Group. And I know that the commissioner is here to perhaps speak a little bit more on that. So I will ask for your comment on this, Commissioner Jacobson.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Members of the committee, again, Bob Jacobson, Commissioner of Public Safety for the state of Minnesota. It's my honor to be here. The Department of Public Safety would be opposed to that amendment. We believe that many of the grants that we would be able to obtain would not necessarily have a specific purpose, but would be asking for some kind of an outcome out of that process. For instance, the Deadly Encounters Working Group, as I understand it, if we've been able to receive funds, again, recommendations would come out of that working group. There would be actions that would be requested, and to put some limits on use of those grant funds would certainly make it more difficult for us to be able to get to the work done and to be able to follow up on recommendations or actions made by any one of those working groups.
Further discussion on the A3. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Schnell,
Commissioner Jacobson.
Oh, Jacobson, sorry.
You can call me. You're a lot lately.
Yes,
so
yes.
I understand that.
My apologies. Commissioner Jacobson, when you talk about grant funding received for a particular purpose, are you referring to grants administered by the state or grants that you're receiving from private entities?
Commissioner Jacobson.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, Representative Hudson. Typically, the grants that we would expect to receive would be from nonprofit groups or outside organizations. Again, as to use the example of the Deadly Force Encounters Work Group, organizations that want to see an outcome from this, some actions that come out of a working group, and so that would be the typical organizations that we would get funds from.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a question for either Chair Mueller or Commissioner Jacobson would be, do you see a path beyond this language, which you've expressed opposition to try to affect prohibiting outside organizations from having a impact upon the policy of the Department of Public Safety that has not been deliberated by elected officials?
I don't know if you want to answer this, Commissioner Jacobson, but I'll just say, like, I'm certainly willing to work on language. I completely understand the intent of what this amendment is doing. I just think the language is too limiting, but I'm always open to suggestions on language. And although this is an agency bill, it is our bill now in the legislature. So I'm always willing to work on that. Anything further?
Just that I appreciate it. Thank you.
Anything else, Representative Novotny, to your amendment?
Representative Hudson beat me to the punch there. I'll withdraw the amendment and hope that we can work on this and make it clear and acceptable.
All right. With that, the A3 amendment is withdrawn. So now we will move on to a vote to the underlying DE2 amendment as amended. Those in favor of the DE2 amendment as amended signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The DE2 amendment as amended is adopted. Okay, now we can move on to the official bill presentation. And I believe, Commissioner, that you will be speaking first to the bill. So go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Again, members of the committee. Again, Bob Jacobson, Commissioner of Public Safety. I will just speak briefly about the acceptance of private funds, those appropriations, cover that bill, and then stand for questions, and then I will pass it on to Superintendent Evans and to other members of the Department of Public Safety. Again, DPS is, we are requesting a fairly straightforward bill that we may be able to accept donations, non-federal grants, bequests, other gifts of money to carry out the purposes of Chapter 299A, which again talks about the powers and duties of public safety. We think that being able to accept those grant funds from interested organizations can help us better follow our mission, be able to bring stakeholders and other local nonprofits and foundations to the table. And we think it's an important issue to communities, especially as it revolves around safety or other issues that we can work through. And with that, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you. Next, we have Superintendent Drew Evans. Welcome back to the committee. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I will be talking about beginning at Section 9, which is on line 6.20. This first portion is a policy proposal that we have proposed that would deal with our question identity process. Individuals across Minnesota often their identity is used, their identity gets put oftentimes on a criminal history when their name is used as an alias. An example would be that two siblings and one sibling is the one that gets in trouble on a regular basis and the other doesn't, but they've used their sibling's alias on that and gets put on their criminal history. What this bill would do is it would allow us to codify our current practice, which is involved for many years at the BCA, but the individual request review by the BCA, they would provide us with photo identification. They provide documentation or information that shows they are the subject of question identity. The BCA takes fingerprints for verification to show that they are not the individual in the alias that's listed. If confirmed, we provide them with a letter from the BCA indicating they are subject of question identity. And then we denote any aliases on the state criminal history system and work with local agencies to denote those alias and arrest warrants. So that process has been in place. Part of the process and the request here is to codify this in statute so it's more clear to citizens as they're trying to examine how to address this process. But the second piece of this is that we currently cannot remove an alias from a criminal history record without a statutory authority due to FBI rules. So the expansion we would do with this is we would add photographs to related arrest warrants that we would add in so that there's a photograph as law enforcement is pulling up the warrant so they can see the individual that's the subject of the actual warrant. We would also be authorized to remove an alias from criminal history record in consultation with our local criminal justice agencies that may be impacted. We would be able to do this then if it didn't negatively impact any future cases that would be going forward after a period of time, and so that would give us the mechanism to remove that alias from the criminal history of an individual when it's appropriate, and there's a number of factors that would go into place as we're examining that. And Chair, would you like me to pause at each section for questions, or would you like me to move through the BCA proposals?
Why don't you finish moving through yours, and then before we move on to the other testifiers, we'll stop and do questions for both of you on the parts you've covered already. Go ahead.
Sounds good. Chair Mulder, the second section is Section 10 pertaining to the BCA, beginning at line 7.26. This is a expansion of a current advisory board that we have in process right now. This advisory board at the BCA is called the Criminal Justice, The first portion of this proposal is to expand the use of the Criminal Justice Data Network. We have a Criminal Justice Data Network that our law enforcement partners and other criminal justice partners utilize that's a secure network across the state of Minnesota. A few years back, we cleaned up the statutory language related to this data network to make it clear what could be used. There was an unintentional consequence as we were doing that, and the language that we passed that currently it prohibits transmission of video across the criminal justice data network. As body cams have come online and that law enforcement are using different networks to store that information, it has required them to bifurcate transmitting video across that, in other words, using a different network and the criminal justice data network. We can handle the volume on the criminal justice data network from a transmission perspective, and so this would be the first part of this would be allowing the use of that to coincide with the current advances in technology and how that network should be used. The second portion of this is expanding the role of the Criminal Justice and Juvenile Information Advisory Group to add an BCA Advisory Group. It's a long term, but that group is currently a meeting and in statute, and they felt it was important as we consulted with them to remain that portion of the name, and they examined the uses of our criminal justice systems across Minnesota, integration, all different ways to look at criminal justice information sharing. That group is already in statute and represents a broad swath of stakeholders, and so as we are examining policy proposals related to this, we felt that there was room to provide further advice to the BCA on different policy proposals, whether it's a change in our evidence acceptance policies, whether it's an audit that we're doing, whether or not it's an emerging technology issue that we should be looking at. This would expand the role of that advisory group that's already codified and represents that broad stakeholder group to be able to take a look at some of those different issues from, like I mentioned, from audits to all types of different things that we could look at, maintaining the current structure that's already in statute to provide better advice to us to meet the needs of Minnesotans and our stakeholders and our law enforcement partners across Minnesota. The next item for the BCA will be on, forgive me as I page through, will be on section 15, which is the computer or electronic data theft. This arose in a case that we were investigating with one of our cyber intrusion cases that was a theft it wasn't the theft ultimately. That's why the policy proposal is here. But it was an individual that purposely hacked in to a school district database that housed the information for parents and their credit card information for the school lunch program. The individual copied it. They didn't take it. They downloaded it. They took a copy of that, but they did not actually use it for identity theft purposes or use the data in a way that actually resulted in an actual loss. And so the suggestion in this case would be that that individual, we shouldn't wait until an actual nefarious use of that data is used, that there was an intentionality in that process to take that, hold that, that would be able to be held criminally accountable. There's a analogous statute that covers this at the federal level, but due to thresholds that often are not met in that case, this would create a similar a process so that we could prosecute an individual who does that with intentionality at the state level. And then I think that covers the BCA's portions, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. We'll pause right here for the sections that you both have covered already to see if there are any member questions to those sections. Representative Whitney.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you for the additions to identity theft. That is a big problem for the person whose identity has been used, and especially when they're out on a traffic stop. So I think those pieces are going to be very helpful. So thank you for making those changes.
Further discussion? All right, moving right along then. We have Kate Weeks and then Jim Smith. Executive Director Weeks, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs with the Department of Public Safety. First, I'd like to just touch briefly on the provisions. It's an OJP technical fix found in House File 1648. This proposal corrects several instances of outdated and inconsistent statutory language related to OJP statutory responsibilities that were not corrected when Crime Victim Services moved from the Department of Public or Department of Corrections over to the Department of Public Safety in 2003. The language amends state statute to reflect that OJP has a responsibility to designate programs providing services to victims of domestic abuse. In addition, it removes outdated language referring to an expired report requirement. The second provision related to OJP streamlines victim notification requirements and were found in House File 1647. Currently, crime victims have rights under the Minnesota Crime Victim Bill of Rights in Chapter 611A. Under this chapter, prosecutors may have many responsibilities towards victims with regard to providing information about the case and notification of important events during the prosecution period. This proposal provides clear direction on the responsibility to notify victims of plea and sentencing hearings, making sure that victims get notice of these hearings. In addition, to ensure that victims know about sentencing modifications, the proposal shifts the notification responsibility also to prosecutors. And there's a couple of reasons for this. Oftentimes, courts do not have victim information, so this proposal better ensures that victims will be notified. Prosecutors often have this victim notification and provide information regularly already. This proposal makes the practice uniform across the state. The third provision under the Office of Justice Programs relates to the Crime Victim Reparations Program, and those changes are found in House File 1713 and mentioned throughout the DE amendment. The first piece replaces the word reparations with the word reimbursement throughout section 611A. This is the statutory provision that authorizes the Crime Victim Reparations Program, which outlines eligibility requirements and establishes the board and process. The name change aligns Minnesota with the majority of other states, and it makes it clear that this is a reimbursement program. The second provision allows the program to rely on information from prosecutors and other professionals familiar with the case to establish cooperation with law enforcement officials. A provision of 611A requires that no reparations must be awarded to a claimant otherwise eligible if the victim or claimant failed or refused to cooperate fully with police or other law enforcement officials. This provision Our proposal provides that claimants or victims may provide additional statements from providers or advocates associated with the victim and incident to show that the victim did attempt to cooperate with law enforcement officials. This proposal does not negate law enforcement's determination in these cases. It just affirmatively allows other information to be included in the record for consideration by staff and the board. The third proposal that we are, the third piece that is included in this proposal would prohibit a determination of contributory misconduct based on the person's current or past affiliation with a particular group. Currently, an applicant faces a denial or reduction of their claim if there is determination of contributory misconduct. This proposal maintains that if someone contributes or maintains that contributory misconduct will result in a reduction or denial, meaning if someone caused the harm or caused something that led to their harm, they would not benefit from Minnesota's Crime Victim Reparations Program. However, there are no consistent, comprehensive ways to make these determinations, and we are asking that this we remove the ability for someone to make an assumption about a person. And so we are asking for that piece to be removed, that you cannot make an assumption based on a person's past affiliation, because there is not a concrete way to make that determination. But we do would like to maintain that contributory misconduct would prevent someone from being able to participate in this program. And I stand open for questions.
All right, yeah, we'll go ahead and pause for questions here. There's a lot. Anybody? Y'all are quiet today. It's okay. I'm not asking for more. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. I'm wondering, is this in competition with a victim reimbursement process that is already in existence in public policy that's managed by the state and doesn't involve nonprofit groups?
Director Weeks.
Chair Moeller, Representative. So the Office of Justice Programs operates Minnesota's Crime Victim Reparations Program for the entire state. We work directly with claimants and victims, not nonprofit agencies. And so this program isn't in conflict with another program that would be run by nonprofits. The only way that nonprofits are involved in this process is oftentimes victims will seek services, and an advocate at that nonprofit may help fill out the form, because sometimes if someone is in trauma or they're in crisis, sometimes it's hard to sit and fill something out, so they often work with victims with that process. But that victim or claimant then submits that information to us, and we work directly with the victims and families.
Anything further?
Nope, thank you for the clarification.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? All right, thank you. Next up, we have the State Fire Marshal, Jim Smith. Welcome, and please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. For the record, my name is Jim Smith, and I am the State Fire Marshal for the state of Minnesota. Before you in your packet, you will see that the Fire Marshal Division has recommended some changes to language specific to primarily the 299A part of the statutes. The state assets that I'll be referring to today are our hazardous material response teams, which we have 11 of. We also have 4 bomb squads and 2 urban search and rescue teams and 1 air rescue team. Since the state fire marshal oversees the operations of these 4 unique emergency response assets, it's important to rename the Minnesota Hazardous Material Incident Response Act to the Minnesota Emergency Incident Response Act, which would include then all assets that are under the oversight of the State Fire Marshal Division, all state teams. Current statute does not acknowledge the urban search and rescue teams, bomb squads, and air rescue teams. Because of this omission, it makes it extremely difficult to fully reimburse all state assets for specific emergency responses, invoicing responsible parties for scheduled activities, and also providing funding and or reimbursement for non-reimbursable responses, For an example, national security events such as a dignitary coming into the state to visit, we are required to have a state hazardous material team and a bomb squad shadow that dignitary as they move through the state. Surprisingly enough, the federal government doesn't reimburse us for those activities. And so we, by including the language that you see before you, it would make it possible that we would be able to reimburse their, the teams for their response. The same, the State Fire Marshal Division is also recommending to remove the two terms chemical assessment team and emergency response team. These designations do not align with the federal standards in referencing to typing a response team. The federal government types emergency response teams, type 1 through type 5, sometimes up to type 6. Type 1 being the most robust in equipment and staffing. Excuse me, I'm dealing with a cold. Excuse me.
I can relate.
On the end of it. And type, you know, as the numbers grow bigger in typing, the size and scope of responsibilities decreases. And that is the model that we would like to move toward. It'll help with future grant funding, and we need to remove the chemical assessment team and emergency response team monikers just so we can align with the federal government. A study conducted by MAD a number of years ago was completed, and it was determined that the current statute that states up to five regional teams, we need to remove that because depending upon resources throughout the state, we're not sure if five is the correct number. We may, through the typing model, add a couple more teams, maybe a type four or something like that throughout the state. So the team numbers would probably exceed five. So we would like to have that flexibility to place these state assets where they can most benefit the citizens of Minnesota. Moving down, the current term of responsible person, or it's hopefully be changed to party, allows the commissioner to invoice for costs where there is an identified party. This new language will allow all state teams to utilize this reimbursement model when applicable. This recommendation also includes new language that will allow DPS to invoice for non-emergency responses, which are occasionally requested by third parties. We do have a number of events throughout the year where specifically our bomb squads are asked to come and do an explosive sweeps. We have no method of invoicing those third parties for the services rendered, and that's had to come out of contractor compensation. We believe that should they request those services, we should be able to invoice for those services. This would not include any emergency response such as we had a year ago down to Lakeville South, where the bomb squad responded to a sweep of the school due to a bomb scare. We're not going to invoice the school district for that response. That's an emergency response as opposed to a planned event. Lastly, the Fire Marshal Division recommends changing the language of the non-responsible party fund to better illustrate what it is used for. Also, you will note that the appropriation recommendation has the funding or residual funding moving back to the general fund. Historically, the non-responsible party fund has been funded through the fire safety account. Due to the language change that we are proposing and including more teams, there needs to be a more robust non-responsible party fund. And in the governor's bill, you will note that there is an ask of $750,000 out of the general fund. So we thought it appropriate that we make sure that the residual funds from that, the general fund, go back to the general fund. Lastly, if you refer to Section 13 regarding smoke detectors, historically Minnesota statute has generally used the term smoke detector to capture all styles of devices that either detect or alarm occupants of smoke. modern fire protection terminology differentiates between smoke alarm and smoke detector. Smoke alarms are the devices found most commonly in your homes and residential buildings, hotels, motels, and by code they are to be there to alert the occupants. Smoke detectors are devices that are connected to a centralized fire alarm system. They are also mandated by code in certain situations, but the Minnesota State Fire Code does differentiate between the two. By changing the language in the statute to refer to these devices as smoke alarms, it'll align with the language currently in the Minnesota State Fire Code. With that, I stand for questions.
Thank you. Any questions for the fire marshal? All right, I'm not seeing any. Thank you.
Thank you.
And those, that was all that we had for testifiers, and nobody from the public signed up to testify on this bill. So do we have any other further member questions or discussion? All right, I'm not seeing any. So I will renew my motion that House File 1510, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thanks again for all of you for being here today. We appreciate it. And just to be clear, so that people aren't confused with what was posted online, so those individual bills, 1524, 1648, 1647, 1713, 1777, 1759, and 2205, will not be acting on those individual bills. And then our final bill on the agenda today is House File 1124. It's a Lee Novotny bill. And, 1182. And Representative Novotny, I understand that your motion is that 1182 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
That's correct, ma'am.
Okay, and I don't see any amendments, so please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, members of the committee. House File 1182 is a bill that will change requirements for peace officers' authorized use of deadly force as a result of part of the provisions of the public safety bill passed in the summer of 2020. The statutory change requires a threat authorizing a peace officer to use deadly force can be articulated by a law enforcement officer. In December of 2021, a Ramsey County judge ruled that the language in total violates Article 1, Section 7 of the Minnesota State's Constitution, which states no person shall be compelled to be a witness against himself in a criminal case. Judge Castro struck the words "by the law enforcement officer" in statute. This bill codifies the judge's ruling. I think it's important, and this bill was brought forward because when we're doing use of force training, I would hope most use of force trainers would actually bring up the actual statutes and have the officers, as part of their training, review the exact wording that they will be judged on should they use deadly force. And I think it's important to have that for an easily referenced language. Someone doing this review is not going to go and look up Judge Castro's ruling. They're going to go to the statute, and that's what they will be used. And in the case of an officer involved use of force, that is what they're going to be asked on their actual knowledge and familiarity with the statutes.
Thank you for that. And I messed up when I brought the bill before. So the motion is that it be placed on the general register, but with a further recommendation that it be placed on the consent calendar. Is that correct, Representative Novotny?
Yes, on the consent calendar, Chair.
Great. That's a new thing for all of us, so I'm just trying to work that out here. I don't see that we had anybody signed up in advance to testify on this bill. Do we have any member discussion? All right, I'm not. Go ahead, Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Lee Novotny, for this. And I just wanted to highlight to your point of, when we're talking about use of force training, we're talking about learning how to be a law enforcement officer, right? That 609.066 is something that gets memorized. I vividly remember a different version when I went to school, but sitting down and writing out the entire statute word for word so that we were able to recite it repeatedly so that we knew this going into any situation. So I do think that it's really important to highlight that, and I appreciate the change. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Corrin.
Further discussion? Closing comments, Representative Novotny.
I think it's a good bill. I think this is the one area that there should be no ambiguous language, and we should all be on the same page for easily referenced and understandable language. Thank you, Chair.
And with that, Lee Novotny renews his motion that House File 1182 be recommended to be placed on the General Register with a further recommendation that it be placed on the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Members, we are done early, which I feel like I should apologize for because of all the extra committees we have this week, but go enjoy the extra time that you have right now. And with that, we are adjourned.